I'll introduce you to a sefer tonight. This is like one of the rabbi's secret books, although I turned it apparently not that big of a secret. You see, for Shemin Atov. Shemin Atov was written by Rabbi, Dov Zev Weinberger, who was the Rav of the Young Israel of Brooklyn. That was before there was like the Young Israel of Avenue J and the Young Israel of Avenue K and the Young Israel of Avenue M. There was just the Young Israel of Brooklyn. It was actually the second Young Israel that was founded. The first one was in the Lower East Side, and then the Young Israel of Manhattan. And then there was the Young Israel of Brooklyn. And he was the second rabbi there. If anybody is interested, everybody has like parents that came from Williamsburg from that era. So there is this book that I, Rabbi Rakefet actually talked about in one of his shirim, A Sukkah is Burning in Brooklyn, I think. A Sukkah is Burning in Brooklyn, which is the memoirs of some fellow who grew up during that era, went on to become astrophysicist or something, and lives in Newton, Massachusetts now. But he talks about how Williamsburg kind of shifted from being this immigrant community to become this Hasidic community and where he exactly fit in. So he has a nice little chapter about the Young Israel of Brooklyn at that time. So he has this, told me to give a little bit of chizuk tonight. So this is a little, I'm not sure what this was, but it was just a fascinating take from an introduction that he gave. Maybe it gives chizuk to the Rebbeim, or maybe it gives chizuk to those that are not in chinuch. You can tell me how you take this. But he quotes from, in his introduction, by the way, volume 4 somehow I've had the most success with. I don't know if you, whatever volumes you could actually find are. Yeah. One time I found the YU's farm sale, and like there's like a section of books that nobody has wanted for a while, and they've kind of been trying to sell them for a long time. So like $6 a pop. So I only have volumes 3, 4, and 5, but volume 4, and when I've heard it quoted, they always seem to come from volume 4. So volume 4 is where it's at. But he has a, he quotes from Yisrael Salanter, or a story, that somebody once asked him, that why is it that you have all these Rosh Yeshiva, these rabbis of shuls, and you know, rabbis and yeshivas and stuff, and they always have something to say. They always have a Dvar Torah. If you're a Rosh Yeshiva, they always have a Chiddush. Every single sugya that you learn through in yeshiva, somehow they have something to say about it that's a Chiddush, that's a new idea. So how does that happen? And meanwhile, those that are not in that profession, so they're like stuck struggling. They learn along, but the idea of having a Chiddush, the idea of having something to say over, so that's much more difficult to come by. So he says, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter answered back, he said, because those people that do this for a living, those people that say shirim, those people that say divrei Torah for a living, so it's a living, that it's part of their job. And guess what? When you have a job, so your parnasa comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, your parnasa comes from Hashem. So Hashem is going to give you all that you need in order to have a job. So it's not them coming up with the chiddush, it's Hashem providing them with an opportunity, with the ability to earn a living. So he goes on, so those people that aren't paid for it, so it's for them, HaKol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Meir Shemayim. For them it has to do with Yir Shemayim. It has to do with only things having to do with their connection with Hashem, their hard work. So when somebody is not in the field and comes up with something, so it's much more impressive. So then he goes on and talks about how, so he retired, apparently volume 3 he retired, and volume 4 he's now moved someplace else, and he's no longer in his shul with Balabatnam, he's in a shtibel with the rest of an yeshiva. And he said, and every once in a while they ask me to speak, but I find it a lot harder to actually come up with anything to say. When I was a rabbi of a shul, it was no problem, and now it's a lot harder. And the only reason they ask me is because I'm an old man, they want to give me a little bit of kavod, but really, there's no reason why they should ask me over anybody else. So for those that do this for a living, so don't think so highly of yourself. And those people that don't do this for a living, don't get so depressed, right? There's plenty of learning that's available for everyone. And even those experienced rabbis, once they left the rabbinate, they had trouble coming up with shirim, divrei Torah, chidushim, etc., etc. Okay, so now to turn to this week. So the pasuk tells us that after the tsarua, or the mitzora, that after he's told that he's confirmed as a mitzora and he's got to leave the entire camp. And famously, he sits out in the middle of the camp, he puts on this black clothing, and he's covered, and out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, out of the camp meant out of the camp. You don't really know what that means when you're living in a place like Philadelphia, where out of the camp means north of Boston or south of Washington. When I lived in Arizona for a couple of years, you actually could see the end of the camp, because it was a big Indian reservation. That's why Phoenix is a big L. There's nothing there. So it's totally black, and all of a sudden, you're in the middle of the city. So you actually can see Tchum Shabbos, right after all of the houses that they built and couldn't sell, right? Those end, and then there's nothing. It's desert. So this guy is out. So this fellow's out in the middle of nowhere, and he's announcing Tamei Tamei Yikre. He's announcing I'm Tamei. So why is he announcing that he's Tamei? So the Gemara in Moed Katan says one of the things that one is permitted to do on Chol HaMoed, they're allowed to make tzionim, they're allowed to make matzevos, or at least markers for where a person died. So the Gemara asks, how do we know that you're allowed to make matzevos to know where a person died? So he says, oh, I know, we learn it out from, first it has one proof, and then the second proof is we learn it out from the Mitzora. We learn it out from him. Because why is he saying Tamei Tamei Yik? Why is he announcing everybody, to anybody that comes by Tamei Tamei? So he has two possibilities. Number one, because he's Tamei, right? And he doesn't want anybody to come near. So he's near. He says, no, stay away. Tamei Tamei, you have to make sure to stay away from me. So the second possibility that the Gemara brings down Moed Katan is, no. He's actually announcing Tamei Tamei so that whoever goes and hears him, and anybody goes who sees him, is going to offer a tefillah on his behalf. He's going to daven on his behalf. So what are the two different reasons? Number one, because he doesn't want them to become Tamei. And number two, because he wants a tefillah for himself. So one of them is self-serving, right? The tefillah for himself. This way I announce that I'm sick, you'll daven for me. And the other one is to provide for the other person, in order to help out the other person. So that's Gemara number one. So then he quotes Gemara number two. So Gemara number two is a Gemara in Baba Kama. The Gemara in Baba Kama says that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So what's the proof that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Bikurim. How does Bikurim preach that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? So the Mishnah tells us in Bikurim that it was a big parade and everybody would bring their first fruits in this beautiful parade with the instruments, and the whole towns would come in and everybody would greet them, and everybody was excited. Donald Trump would be at the front because he's the Grand Marshal of all the Israel parades, and they would all... And everybody was excited about it, but only people that could afford nice baskets would actually bring nice baskets. And those people that couldn't. So the wealthy people could afford nice baskets, you know, those big shalach manos things that you get. So they would bring it there. And then they would bring their bikurim. And then what do they do with the baskets afterwards? So the wealthy people who brought nice stuff, they would say, okay, here's the fruit. I'd like my basket back because it costs money and it's reusable, so I'll just use it again next year. So the wealthy get to keep it. While the poor people, they bring it in the plastic bags. They bring it in the little plastic that's tied around in a little knot. So it looks very nice right away, but it kind of falls apart after a while. So what would they do with the plastic after they took out all of the fruit and gave them for Bikurim? So they would throw in the garbage. So not only did they lose the Bikurim, they also lost the packaging that brought it in. So the Gemara says, the poor get poorer, because not only do they bring the food, but they also lost the stuff that they bring it in, as opposed to the rich people that remember to take it back. So then the Gemara says, well, I have another idea that the poor get poorer, and that is the Mitzora. How does the poor get poorer? So the Mitzora, the guy who has Saras, and now is stuck out in the middle of the place, so he's already considered poor. And then what does he then have to do? He then has to announce Tamei Tamei. He then has to announce to everybody that goes by, oh, me, you know why I'm here dressed, like, don't think that I'm crazy or anything. It's because I happen to have this saras thing, and that's why I'm stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. So the Gemara says that's considered the poor becoming poorer, because not only is he stuck out there, but he also has to announce to everybody. He also has to go through this embarrassment of displaying that, and making sure that everybody, and showing everybody that he... that he's achieved that status. So how does one compare? So on one hand, the two reasons before. So according to reason A, that he has to announce it in order to warn the other person. So that fits very well. I have to announce it to warn the other person, and Nebuch, I have to embarrass myself. But if you go like the other opinion, the first part, that he's announcing it so that he could be davened for, so that the people will feel bad for him and offer up a couple of tefillos, so why is that considered getting poorer? So, Rav Weinberger explains that that there is an exchange going on. That even when the person is getting tefillos from other people, when we drive by, so and you in Philadelphia, and you see people that are come and knock on your windows or something. So what do we think about that? So generally, we think about, are my doors locked? I remember to lock my doors. But do we then, what do we think about them? Do we offer tilos on their behalf? So maybe not. Maybe we think, oh, I wish these people weren't around, and can all these people be taken care of so they don't knock on my windows anymore? But we don't necessarily offer those words. Do we feel bad? Do we not feel bad? We might feel bad for the situation. We don't necessarily feel bad for the individual. So how does one achieve that? Not necessarily in those situations, but a situation of the guy out in the desert. So how does one achieve the ability that somebody is going to daven on their behalf? Only if somebody is willing, if you're willing to do something for them first. Right, so by announcing, by saying out loud, tell me, I'm embarrassing myself. Why am I embarrassing myself? Because I care. I don't want you to be stuck in the same situation that I'm stuck. I don't want you to not be able to have a truma tonight or whatever being tummy entails. I don't want you to be stuck with that. So I'm going to announce it to everybody. I'm willing to embarrass myself. I'm willing to suffer. I'm willing to do things in order to make sure that you're safe. So in return for that, in return for what I've done for them, so therefore they're going to offer tefillos on my behalf. That it works both ways. That we have both have a role in this dialogue here. Right? I'm going to tell you not to come near me, and therefore you're going to offer me tefillos on my behalf. So one has to, you have to make sure that we're, that even when a person feels like they're degrading themselves, even when a person feels like, well, is this really the thing that I'm supposed to be doing right now? Is this really, do I have to do this right now? If it's done on somebody else's behalf, so that A counts as a chesed, that counts as a kindness that you're doing for them, and then perhaps a person should treat it as such. If I'm doing something in order to help out somebody else, so often we think of it as a chore. Often we think of it as, okay, what can I do? I'd rather be doing something else, but this is something that I need to do right now. But if I think about it as, no, this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. This is my job right now. I have a role of this chesed that I'm going to do. I have this role of the dishes that I'm going to do. I have this role of hanging out with my children for the afternoon. That's my role. So then one can have an entirely different perspective on the issue. You can look at it as, Nebuch, I'm embarrassing myself at being out and yelling to everybody that I'm tameh. Or I can look at it as, I'm trying to help everybody out. I'm doing a chesed. I'm doing kindness on their behalf. The Gemara in Shabbos, and Kuf Yud Tes, the Gemara in Shabbos Kuf Yud Tes, so it describes all of the Amorayim, what they did for their household on Erev Shabbos. And it describes the most famous one is Rav Anan, that Rav Anan would wear a smock on Erev Shabbos. Why would he wear a smock on Erev Shabbos? Because of all the things that he would do around the house, he was afraid that he would get his clothing dirty. And by getting his clothing dirty, it's not improper to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu directly with his dirty clothing. So therefore, he would cover his clothing on Erev Shabbos so that he himself wouldn't get dirty. And then it goes on and lists everybody else, Rav Safra, Rava, Rav Huna, Rav Chista, all of them, they would do something specifically on Erev Shabbos. One would clean the fish. One would cut the fish. One would clean the space. One would set the candles. They would all do all of these things. Why are they doing all these kinds of things? So it could be that their wife asked them to. It could be that they saw that there was a need to do it. But the Gemara is highlighting the fact that not only am I doing this because I'm stuck. What am I supposed to do? I'm doing this because I have an opportunity to do chesed. That's part of my kavod for Shabbos. That's part of my honoring the Shabbos. And one can have this perspective. There's a famous story. Tell me if you've heard this before. I told my students that you may have had. I think all of them know this story by now. The story of the Rosh Chagah Feivel Mendelovitz. Very simple story, but it gave me such an insight that Rosh Chagah Feivel Mendelovitz ran Yeshiva Torah Vadas, or Masifta Torah Vadas. He ran that institution, 30s, 40s, 50s. He's credited with building that yeshiva. Rekhetet often complains that Rosh Chagah Feivel, that in the art school books, he gets too much credit for bringing Torah to America. There was YU beforehand, there was Yeshiva, whatever. But he was a pretty impressive individual, and he had many things to offer teachers how to teach. And there's once two desks that were that were two kids that came into the room, and the room was full. There are no desks for those two kids. So what do the two kids do? So they go to another room and they take the desks out. So they schlep two desks in, and they sit down. Shraga Feigl says, no, sit in the other person's desk. So why should I sit in the other person's desk? Because if you bring a desk in for yourself, you're a schlepper. If you bring a desk in for your friend, so you're a Baal Chesed. And that actually like became a thing in my shir when I was teaching in TA, that they had to bring stuff in, so they'd always bring it in for somebody else. Rabbi, I'm not a schlepper. See, I brought it in for him. That became it. But I think that's a very important, not just the idea of looking for opportunities, but the idea that when I'm doing something for on behalf of somebody else, it can be upgraded to a Baal Chesed. And one would have entirely different perspective on that activity that one is doing. There was, I don't know if anybody heard, it was masterful. Rav Meir Tursky gave a hesped for his brother, I think the Shloshim or a little bit later. So, I don't know, it's about an hour long. Many stories, many different things that are contained within it. The one that I took home, he tells a story that Rav Moshe Tursky, Hashem Yikom Damam, would travel. We would go to various places just to gain from yeshivas, gain from rebbes. Like he would leave and he went to Gateshead for an elul, just to be there for an elul, to see what he could gain from there. Not necessarily I'm becoming a Talmud there, but I'm going to see what I could gain from there in order to enhance my own avodas Hashem. So he explains that one Hanukkah, Rav Moshe Tursky went to see a certain rebbe who lights Hanukkah candles for an hour. I assume there's only one of them, right? The option of a Rebbe, right? Anybody else? So he wants to go see this. Why did he want to go see this? Because, not necessarily that he intends on lighting candles, spending an hour lighting Hanukkah candles going forward, but maybe there's something that I could gain from that that will enhance my own, his own avodas Hashem. So Rav Meir Tursky records that, so I asked him, so what do you think? what did you learn from it? Like, were you really impressed by the ability to light Hanukkah candles for an hour? They said, no, I wasn't that impressed by that. To that, I could do that too. I think that was the language. I could do that too. I could get to that point as well. So I'll tell you what did impress me. What impressed me was is that afterwards, there was a little boy that came over to the Rebbe with a question, and it wasn't like a hard question, and the kid was mumbling, and he was looking at his shoelaces, and he was doing all these whatever, and the Rebbe waited there patiently and quietly for the kid to finish, and then he gave him a solid, patient answer back. And how does he get about to doing that? Because it's not about where do I have to go and what are the things that I have to do next. It's about what is my role as an Eved Hashem right now. What are the things that I can do right now? What is my role? What can I do right now that nobody else has the ability to do? I'll tell you, somebody who speaks to Rav Schachter with Shilas often, I didn't grasp this when I was in yeshiva, though thinking back of this, I realized that it was true then as well. But often when I would call various poskim with questions that come up or issues that come up, so generally I start asking the question and then they cut you off in the middle and they give you some answer, whatever, they gotta go, and that's the end of the story. Rav Shafi has this amazing ability to just listen. And he will not, like somebody gave it out, are you still there? But you he will just listen to you. He will listen to your entire question. He will listen to your whatever svaros that you have. Before I would call him, I would try to research it myself. I'd come up with my own ideas, etc. A story about that I tell you off tape. He would listen to the entire thing and then we'll give an approach. He'll answer back. But I didn't realize it at the time, but that's unique. That's not an easy thing to do. This person is very busy. He has people calling him all hours of the day. Usually when I speak to him, it's someplace between 10:30 and 11:30 at night. And and I'm not the only one that he's speaking to at that point. He's got a list of people to speak to. And the ability to patiently realize that these are the things I need to do. That was another thing that Rav Tursky said about his brother Rav Moshe. That anybody that came to him, that wanted to talk to him, he would speak calmly and wasn't, I need to get back to my learning right now. This is my role right now. I can do something for you that nobody else has the ability to do. And I'm going to devote myself 100% to that aspect of my avodah. In fact, I had this experience yesterday. So I was speaking with somebody from another country. I was going through a hard time. He's going on and on. And after 20 minutes or so, I'm thinking, okay, I really got to go. I I'm sure to prepare for it. Like, I really got to go. And he's, and I kept reminding myself of that story. Okay, I know I have other things to do. And I think often that line of, oh, I need to get back to my learning, or I need to get back to something which might be very chashuv, something that might be very important to do. So often that's the Yetzer Hara. Often that is something trying to drag you away from what I'm otherwise supposed to do. Oh, I can't do something around the house because I need to go do X, Y, and Z, which might be an important thing. Often that's the Yetzer Hara. Often that is something that you're really not supposed to do. Often, right, the role right now is to be doing the act of chesed. The one has the ability that is open to one at that moment. And that perhaps leads to a shot that I gave Tommy Tommy many years ago. I think my first, I don't know if any people remember there was a Virginia Tech shooting a couple of years, like one of the early days of the mass shooting. So there was this shooting in Virginia Tech. So that was, I think I'd been a rabbi for about 2-3 months. And that was, I think, like the first event that I was thinking, like, oh, is this an event that I have to speak about in shul the next day? Like do I have to somehow construct a sermon in order to fit that in? So I remember calling somebody and said, yeah, no, you do, okay, fine. So, all right, this is going to be the first one. And guess what? It's Parshas Tezria. Great. Parshas Tezria is hard enough in the first place coming up with anything to say. I've got to come up and fit it towards this. And so this pasuk hit me, and the Rashi hit me. If we look at that Rashi, Tami Tami Yikre, why does it say? So Rashi only quotes one of the reasons in that Gemara and Moed Katan. Rashi says, why do you have to say Tami Tami? Because somebody might otherwise come close to you. So I was thinking, who is this guy out in the middle of the desert? Out in the middle of the desert, no one else is around. He's wearing black. He's got skin ailments. His hair is growing long. His fingernails haven't been cut. And yet, who's the guy who's going to be going over to him and saying, by the way, Nu, how you doing? What in the world are you doing out here? Who is that guy who's going to go over to him? But yet you see that was the expectation. He has to announce himself because the expectation is that there are other people that are going to come over to him at that moment. Well, you could find any excuse not to. Most people, you know, you're walking along, a father with the son, and the son says, "Dad, you want to go over there?" He's a little dangerous. You know, it might be contagious. I don't think it's really. I got a kid with me. You could find any excuse not to do it. But yet, the assumption was that this guy, and it probably aren't that many people, otherwise it wouldn't be considered chutz l'machane, right? It, obviously there aren't too many people around. The role of that person at that time was to go over to this person and say, Nu, how you doing? And then the role of the responder is to say, oh, don't come too close, tame, I'm tame. And then the role of the one going to visit is, oh, okay, I can't come too close, but you're okay, but you're out here, so I should daven on your behalf. Those are the rules, that's the interchange of the roles that's going on there. So I tied it in there that, you know, somebody maybe, the whole word on the street, this guy was a loner that nobody ever talked to, so maybe somebody should have said hello to everyone, whatever. But I think that's important. Everybody, when one is, often people come up with unique circumstances that they themselves have the ability to do that no one else is able to do, and sometimes we just kick them to the side, and sometimes we take the opportunity to do them and realize that it could be very rewarding. There is perhaps the most primary example of that is what's coming up in a couple of weeks. Now, looking around, I'm not sure how many people here have kids yet. But there is a mitzvah over the course of Seder night, one of the very important ones of V'gadta Levincha B'yom HaLemor, of actually teaching the story of leaving Egypt to one's children. And we've probably heard that people would go to Tzaddikim Seder expecting that they'd be in deep Torahs and everything, and there was very simple Seder. Right, because that's the mitzvah of the night, especially if you have your kids there. Often, I think people forget this. You get to Manishtan, you say Manishtan in, you know, five different languages, everybody does their thing, and then the kids leave. But the mitzvah of that night is not to hear them say Manishtana. The mitzvah of that night is Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. And Pesach is unique. I never realized this until I became the rabbi of a shul. It's really the only, what we call, big mitzvah that isn't done in shul. Right, Megillah is done in shul. Chanukah is lit in the house, but still, it's like Chanukah is kind of like a shul holiday. Sukkot is eating their sukkahs at home. There's nothing really specific about that, but Lulav and Esrog is, Pesach is this big thing with a lot of direction. You actually have to give direction, so you have to know kind of what you're doing. And it's not done in shul. It's not done as a community. Rather, it is done. It's done individually, unless you have a community seder or something like that. But it's done individually, and that's the responsibility of certainly of the person leading the seder. But each parent has to teach their children. Hashem took me out of Egypt and took us out of Egypt, and make sure that the story is told over in that night. And perhaps the uniqueness of that mitzvah, that it's done privately, is because that's a unique role that every parent can do for their individual child. That a parent knows their child best. A parent has a responsibility to pass over a specific, no pun intended, but to pass over specifically the way that they think that it's most appropriately to be told over to their kid. And that is, and that's their role. That's their role on Seder night. It's not about all of the fancy Haggadahs and the fancy vorts that one can find. It's specifically a responsibility that you have on that night to teach one's kids in the best way that one possibly can. And the truth is, that's what Hashem did himself. Right? We say it over the course of the Gada, that Hashem comes down, leave lo acher, me not as lo malach, lo saraf, that it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu have to come himself? So I once, Rabbi Rosenblatt, I did my internship at the RJC, so Rabbi Rosenblatt used to have conference calls before Yom Tovim. He used to say whatever Josh's concepts were on his mind at that particular moment. So I looked through my notes, I don't remember if he quoted this from anybody, but the idea that that Mitzrayim had become so immoral, it had become so difficult to deal with, affecting the Jews as well. I mean, we don't always realize this. The Jews weren't exactly tzaddikim when they left Egypt. They were at the 39th level of Tumah. That's what it means. They were in pretty bad shape. But the only one that could recognize their children, the only one that could figure that, only the only parent that could find their child, was the Kadosh Baruch Hu finding his children. The blood on the doors was not about telling Hashem that we're here. Rather, it was demonstrating to us that we actually have the courage to be saved by Kadosh Baruch Hu. But the need on that night was that Hashem himself would come and save us, and it's our responsibility on that night to make sure that we ourselves teach our children the sipur, the tale of leaving Egypt. And I'll conclude with one thing specifically. As I was working on this, all of a sudden I realized that this actually has a very close personal connection. Rabbi Weinberg from here, Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberg from here. So I actually heard him tell this. He referred to this story on. And then I looked it up and I did a little bit of the research, realized that it actually is told over by the Rav of my grandfather's town. So my grandfather was grew up in Hungary, and he grew up in a very small shtetl, and then in order for him to go to Cheder, they moved to a town called Chust. So Chust is a pretty, you might have heard that term, especially if you're Hungarian. I'm only a quarter Hungarian, that quarter. But he was in, he lived up in Chust. Chust was the Yeshiva Maram Shik, Talmud of the Chassam Sofer, and the Rosh the Rav of that town was someone named Rav Yeshua Greenwald. He wrote a sefer. So he went to that town was and his, so he is he wrote he that town was taken to Auschwitz, and this is the part I need to now work on a little bit. Was my grandfather described in that story? My grandfather was an Auschwitz survivor. He had numbers on his arm. And so he survived the war, this Rav Yeshua Greenwald. He came to Brooklyn afterwards, built up a small shul, and wrote a sefer called Shaila Chashuvah Chesed LeYoshua. He has an introduction to Chesed LeYoshua where he goes through the story of his community. He was the Rav in this town called Chust. And then he tells the story of what it was like when they were in the ghetto, and then being shipped off to Auschwitz, and then he survived. So he has a quarter. He has a, so it's paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. And I got to work through the whole thing now. But he tells the story that towards the end, as the Nazis were circling in, and they were still having services and things like that. So the first day of Pesach came along, and the Nazis were there. And they told him, "New rabbi of the community, get up and say drasha." They didn't say drasha. say something. Say Torah to your account. Well, you know, they were going to make fun of him. So he says in the sefer, what am I going to say? What am I going to say to my kid with the Nazis on looking? I knew it had to be very short. People have no position to actually sit and listen or anything like that. What am I going to tell them very quickly? So he points to Halach Ma'anya, and he says, part of Halach Ma'anya is Hashta Hacha L'Shana Haba B'Nichorim Hashta, I forgot the words exactly, but this year we're here, next year we'll be free, this year we're here, next year we'll be Ba'ara Di Yisrael. So he said, I understand the next year will be free. I understand next year will be Ba'ar of Israel. But why do we have to say this year we're here? What's the meaning of this year we're here? Why do we have to say we're here? We know where we are. So he said, the explanation is that how did we even get here? The only way that we got here is because, think about all the miracles. And he says, think about all the different people from our community that have already been killed. And he writes, already the millions of people that have been killed. Hungary was taken later in the war. So think about the millions of people that have already been killed. And somehow we're still here. Somehow we're still here. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu had saw it fit that we made it to here already, so may it also see it fit that we'd actually be able to see the bracha again for next year. And I would add in that if he's already thought that we made it here already, so that means that we have some kind of special role. That means that we have something that we are specified, that we have the ability to specifically do that no one else has the ability to do. Generally, that works within our homes, and then we expand from out of there as well. And perhaps we have a specific role. Maybe it's setting up a Thursday night Musarvat. Maybe it's setting up other community things. And perhaps that is the overall lesson of the Tazria Lashon Hara connection. That we don't actually read Lashon Hara doesn't appear in Tazria, but the Gemara does make that connection. Not just that it. Not just that one does get saras for Lashon Hara, but that's the primary thing, the primary connection between them. It's in the Torah itself that Miriam got it. It's not in this parasha, but it's later on. That what is the connection between saras and Lashon Hara? So I once heard on a tape, it must have been an hour and a half tape. Is Rabbi Arlovsky still like popular? We've heard of him, right? So I once heard him give a shiur on Tazria, and he said, and I think the whole thing boiled down to this one idea, that the reason why you get saras for speaking Lashon Hara is that most people think that nothing that I say actually has any meaning. Nothing that I say actually has any impact. It doesn't actually impact anything. And yet we see that it does. And yet you see that when something starts growing on your arms, as a result of something that you say, you realize that your words have meaning. And that, sometimes even people come over to me sometimes, oh, I remember that you gave a drasha 5 years ago, and I finally, I'm shocked. I am shocked that anything that I, even people that do this for a living, I am shocked that actually anything that I say actually makes a difference to people. But somehow it does. Somehow, it's not about me, it's my parnasa. That's the introduction to this, that's how we started with. It's not me, that's my job. So Hashem gives me the ability to earn a little bit of a living. But you should keep that in mind. As we go through this entire season that we're in, there are things that we are uniquely suited for. Cleaning the house, taking care of the kids, washing the... but all of those issues, and then expanding beyond that to things, our learning, our community, things that we can teach, things that we can write, things that we can impact with. And it does impact. It does impact. After a couple of years, you start realizing... couple of the various impacts that one has. So for the next couple of weeks, keep that in mind. Remember, we got to teach our kids Vigat Levincha. That's our mitzvah for that specific night. Remember the mitzvah Sipris Yisrael. Plus, that's something that each one of us are uniquely suited to do. All right? Thank you for having me. All right.